Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Robert Knott, speaking of the arts. Right now, I'd like to welcome Francisco Goldman. He is the award-winning writer of several novels, and his latest book is The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? And he is part of the College of Santa Fe's lecture series, Rebels, Revolutionaries, and Reformers, and will actually be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is the story, The Art of Political Murder, which you'll be talking about tonight, of the murder of Guatemalan Bishop Juan Gerardi in April of 1998. Who was he? Tell us about his work, religious, political, in Guatemala.
Well, that's a really, really long story. But the most important thing, you know, the thing that gets the murder, that provokes the murder, is Bishop Gerardi was the founder of the Guatemalan Archdiocese Office of Human Rights. He was basically number two to the archbishop in the Guatemalan diocese. And this human rights group right out of the church was the first human rights group in Guatemala that could work at a national level through the parishes and so forth. During a period, the 1980s, at the height of the war in Central America and the repression there, when no human rights group could survive, there had been no human rights group in Guatemala throughout those war years, in a period in which, as every 200,000 civilians were killed, disappearances all the time, torture cells, massacres in the mountains. So it was extraordinarily important when he established that group in the early 80s. And as the war, and they did a lot of important work throughout those years, and you have to just remember that because of the reach of the church, because of the role that just Catholic activists had through their parishes, nuns, local priests, it really was a national organization in a way, and had national reach in a way that on the other side only the army could match, right? And so as the war finally comes to a halt, and there are peace negotiations in the mid-90s, culminating in the UN-sponsored peace accords of 1996. We can talk a little bit more about that later. But in the aftermath of that, those peace accords basically forbade Guatemalans, both the guerrillas, part of the deal was that people weren't going to look into the past, really, and try to assign blame for what had happened in this enormous catastrophe. And Bishop Gerardi, as head of the church human rights group, said, well, that's not right. And the church hasn't signed anything, really, and we'll do our own report. And so through this incredible grassroots effort, through the local parishes, 700 people were trained to just answer, trained in how to ask questions, basically, and went out into those mountains and forests and villages and into the slums and everywhere else all across Guatemala, especially into the Mayan hamlets and the Mayan villages where much of the worst atrocities had occurred, places where people speak 16 different languages, often don't even speak Spanish, and pieces that had been sealed away by terror for so long, where there was just enormous mistrust of outsiders, enormous fear of saying anything lest it provoke another attack against you. And they broke through that wall because they were trusted people, they were from the community. And the result was this enormous 4-volume, 1,000-page human rights report that Bishop Gerardi presented at the Guatemala City Cathedral on April 24th, 1998.
Called Guatemala Never Again.
Guatemala Never Again, the Recuperation of Historical Memory Project. And one result of that was that 2 days later, he was murdered in his parish house garage.
So, I mean, this was at the end of the war was over, as you say, hundreds of thousands of people had been killed. There was an amnesty. What was the motivation, if there was an amnesty and everyone was going forward, for killing him? I mean, obviously, it reads like a murder mystery, and people have to read the book to know the details of that. But in other words, I guess the problem is that even if there's an amnesty, when a report like this comes out, it's threatening.
Well, yeah, because what the peace accords had agreed upon was that there could be a UN-sponsored report, but it wouldn't be allowed to assign blame. It wouldn't be allowed to name names. Which is pretty weird. They thought they had neutered it, right? And Bishop Hardy's main fear about the report as well was what I mentioned earlier, the fear people had up in the villages of outsiders. Because it was basically going to be, young Yale graduate students and people like that, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people going up into those mountains. And he knew, well, no one's going to talk to them. The church can begin to break down these taboos against, and can start to puncture this wall of silence. And I guess he understood that eventually there were loopholes in the amnesty. Because, you see, the Guatemalan army had basically, as the victors in the war, and obviously the people who committed 95% of the atrocities, knew that they could impose this on the guerrillas and on everybody else because they were in control. So they could give themselves what they wanted. And that power perhaps kind of blinded them to the fact that under international law, there can't be an amnesty for crimes against humanity, which Bishop Hardy obviously knew were there. And what the Remy Report did, Guatemala Never Again, was begin to lay out the case that in fact these had been real international, Geneva Convention crimes against humanity had occurred in Guatemala, and he basically laid out a map that later when the UN came in, they could follow that map, and they had greater resources and everything else. And of course the result was, as the army must have foreseen when the report came out, the UN finally did declare genocide in Guatemala, say a genocide against the Mayans had occurred, and that, in legal terms, undid the amnesty. So in Guatemala, there is no more amnesty. And you can directly trace
that. To this day.
To this day. I mean, it doesn't mean there's to this day, there isn't yet the infrastructural strength in the Guatemalan courts to bring these people to justice, but if they can, there's no law that says they can't anymore.
Backing up even a little bit beyond that, what was this whole war about, and why a genocide on the humble Mayan peasants in the hillside?
Well, the war, the war basically, on one level, you see it in the context of the Cold War that accelerates throughout Latin America after the victory of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. So a very paranoid kind of outlook in the United States begins to see all, even democratic reform movements, as feeding into an eventual communist takeover of Latin America. On the other side of the equation, there are, coming from Cuba and the Soviet Union, a certain amount of, there's intervention.
Reality to that.
There's intervention also. But what became, specifically in the case of Guatemala, and it's very well documented, Guatemala, as is the 54 coup, when Guatemala had its 1 year of reformist democracy, which had been overthrown, of course, by a CIA-backed coup that reinstituted this just horribly right-wing military dictatorship that backed the coffee-growing oligarchy and had just created a horribly unfair country, a country that basically socially hadn't advanced at all since, the Spanish colonies with a tiny percentage of landed gentry running everything, and a kind of institutionalized racism against the Mayan and Mayas and so forth. After the 54 coup, long before Cuba was even on the map in terms of as a geopolitical concern, there had been reformist movements in Guatemala to reinstate the democracy. And the people in control in Guatemala, kind of right-wing military officers and the very rich, the oligarchs, saw that they could manipulate U.S. opinion and say, these democratic reformers, they're really communists. These people who want to get, reinstate, what was there in 54. And there'd already been, there was already plenty of pre-communist, rebellion going on in Guatemala. But the United States backed them heavily. And essentially while the United States might have argued that they were fighting a war against communism in Guatemala, they were really fighting a war to keep intact this incredibly unfair Guatemalan-created nightmarish society.
And the U.S. interest in that was pretty much like United Fruit Company kind of things?
The United Fruit Company was basically just a pretext. It was basically, you know, a Cold War militant attitude. There's a really, I tell this story early in the book. The book is not really about what happened in Guatemala in the past, but I tell one very important story because it's key to understanding what happened in Guatemala, which is how the Guatemalan military intelligence infrastructure got built up, right? It's John F. Kennedy, when he came in as president, he understood the problem really well. And he said that if we don't make democratic reform possible in these countries, we're going to make communist takeovers inevitable. Because these countries are so innately unjust that they cry out for reform and good, honest people are going to rebel against it. And so he began with the State Department a program of educating intelligent young Guatemalans that they had identified as potential leaders of Guatemalan society, people who could be anti-communist, pro-democracy union leaders, for example. And they sent hundreds of these guys and women up to the United States to be educated. They begin to come back.
And right, get killed by the Guatemalan military.
Which is backed by the CIA,
yeah,
and the United States military.
I know, and the irony of that story is chilling.
70% of them were killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what had happened at the end of the Eisenhower administration is they decided that basically the people are going to do our dirty work for us. The people are going to really be the frontline soldiers in the Cold War are going to be the military intelligence organizations. And they gave them so much largesse. They gave them training. They gave them every kind of high-tech toy. They gave them all kinds of impunity. And they did all the, these are the famous death squads, the torture cells, and so forth. When the war ends, the peace accords say that those military intelligence agencies have to now become civilian. Well, to this day, they're not. And that's really what the Bishop Harady murder is about. And that's really why the Guatemalan military was so threatened by these kinds of human rights reports. Because what has happened since the end of the Cold War is those military intelligence units, which still really control Guatemalan society, obviously they don't have guerrillas to fight anymore. So why are they so determined to hold on to power? Because it's all their power has now been converted to organized crime, especially narcotics trafficking, but every other kind of crime you can imagine, from stolen car rings to contraband to illegal adoptions to, you know, Guatemala's basically a criminal state, and they're the people there who really hold the power. And human rights reports that could bring prosecutions, that could eventually force the military to have to live up to the standards of the peace accords and let these units become civilian, that's the threat. It threatens their hold on, and that's why the ruthlessness of the attack on Bishop Harady and why it becomes such a complicated legal case.
We're talking to author Francisco Goldman. So Bishop Harady gets killed, and immediately there's an investigation. Immediately all sorts of people come up and walk all over the crime scene and tramp the poor bishop's blood all over the house and destroy evidence and so on. But then there's this whole investigation, which you reconstruct in tremendous and really fascinating detail. Who was doing it? I mean, investigating the army, investigating what is clearly a crime based in the kind of dynamics that you're talking about is not something that anybody who values their life probably would want to take on.
This crime was incredibly well thought out, right? You have a country where no military officer has ever been found guilty of a human rights-related crime. They basically have complete impunity to carry out the murders they want, so they can really do a lot of planning. And so this murder was pure theater. I'll talk a little bit more about that tonight. But it was basically a theatrical spectacle made to appear as if Bishop Harati had died in some kind of a homosexual crime, even though he wasn't in the least bit, you know, he wasn't the homosexual. So much planning went into it. They had the corrupt prosecutors on their side at first, a corrupt judge on their side, people placed in the media, people throughout the military and throughout the government. And certainly the police are in their pocket. The police in the 8 years of this case never contribute one, you know, grain of sand of investigation. And so you're right. How would you investigate this case if you are the young people who work for Bishop Harati in the Church Office of Human Rights, and you look at if you're there in the church the night of the murder, this is what you're facing. How are you ever going to get justice in this case? And that's what I think makes this case so extraordinarily important in so many ways, because, as you know, eventually justice was done. And it was one of the most grueling, heroic, remarkable, I think, episodes in contemporary Latin American history. And it begins that night when the young people in the church, and you're right, it sounds completely crazy, decide that they're going to conduct their own investigation. It wasn't as far-fetched as it sounds if you just think of the power of the church. I think that even they didn't understand initially that basically whenever anybody has something to say, whenever anybody has a lead, if anybody knows something, they feel comfortable telling the church. They wouldn't feel comfortable telling anybody else. So a lot of information flows
They've been confessing since they were 5 years
exactly.
old.
Exactly. A lot of information flows through the church, you know, and now 99% of that information was useless. And a lot of it was intentional misinformation.
Well, there were all sorts of false leads, and then one lead, and it's when you're reading what feels like a murder mystery, you, the reader, sit home and say, that's the correct lead. But the people who are getting these leads have to sift out among thousands of obfuscations.
Thousands. And, you know, like in any great mystery story, they got a couple of lucky breaks.
Yeah.
You know, I still think that if, as you know from reading the story, if that taxi driver hadn't blundered on the murder scene that night,
right,
and if he hadn't been the kind of person he in fact was, his murder might still be completely unsolved.
Right.
You know, that was the lucky break that sort of opened things up. And
it's a break that takes a while to develop. I mean, a taxi driver comes in, but nobody knows his name.
No, I mean, the hunt for the taxi driver was spectacular. That's when I came in on the case, because that happened 3 months after the murder, which is about when I arrived there. And I made friends with this group of young guys. They were called the Untouchables, Los Intocables, who were the group of four young men who were basically running the investigation for the church. I mean, all of them in their 20s.
And they slept. They slept, ate, drank, dreamed, and lived the investigation.
Yeah, no, we were basically, I mean, that's part of this, one of the great things about this story is I think there's a stereotype out there that people who do human rights work must be kind of monkish, self-righteous, Puritan people.
Yes,
maybe
super, super earnest.
These are like testosterone-filled, wild boys in their 20s.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like in my late 30s. I'm immature anyway. So we had a great time. You know, it was scary sometimes.
So what was your role? I mean, you go down to, did you know that you were going to be working on this?
I went down to do a piece on the story, on the murder for The New Yorker. In fact,
they said, well, we're not going to really pay you until we decide whether we like the piece or not.
Right.
But here's a letter of introduction.
Yeah, because I'd never worked for them before. And initially the story, as I say, the misinformation in the story was remarkable. And so they had generated this whole false scenario based on a ridiculous reading of autopsy photos by one of the most bizarre characters in this whole case, which is this 80-something-year-old Spanish forensics expert who has a long history of right-wing meddling, and he claimed to have studied autopsy photographs that showed dog bites in Bishop Harati's skull, and the scenario being that Bishop Harati, that the priest who shared Bishop Berardi's parish house with him, Father Mario Orantes, who in fact is a right-wing priest, is a gay priest, is a rather ludicrous, a shady character, had a big German shepherd, and they had cooked
and
up...
And did behave suspiciously on the night of the murder.
Yeah, and was involved. But they cooked up this whole crazy scenario that it had been, that somehow in the midst of this, you know, some kind of, you know, homosexual squabble the night of the church, that the dog had bit Bishop Berardi in the head. And that cooked up scenario ran in newspapers all over the world. That's why I got interested in the story. I saw the big headlines in Spain. Wow. Incredible, surprising revelation in the Bishop Berardi case. Dog bites in his skull, pointing to a crime of domestic passion. I believed it. It was based on that I pitched the story to The New Yorker. It was pitched as a story of, like, what a, you know, lurid, crazy tale. Let's go look into this. And, of course, when I got down there and began looking deeper into it, I realized, this really is the same old story as always. This is probably a political crime.
Well, I mean, how many stories of bishops and nuns and Catholic workers and so on being assassinated in not only Guatemala, but all over Central America and all over South America have we heard since the 80s?
Yeah, but none staged as pure theater like this one.
Yeah.
You know? We know from a previous case, the case of, I guess she was from New Mexico, Sister Diana Ortiz,
right.
A similar case where she was abducted and taken to a torture cell. And I think they didn't realize she was American. And when they did, again, you saw this kind of theater go into motion. And they claimed that she was a lesbian and that, in fact, all those cigarette burns in her body weren't from torture. They were from some lesbian, you know, sadist, that something rather.
Right.
And they churned that out. And you have to remember, spokesmen in the Reagan government gave that credibility.
And people love sexual scandals.
Well, that was the whole idea of this, to just completely smear the church, smear the report, create an enormous soap opera that would basically distract everybody, deflect everybody's attention to what had really occurred, smear the Church Human Rights Office, discredit them. It all worked. It worked for many years.
So what was the... I mean, you read these headlines in Spain. You believed it. The Guatemalan public, who lived through, I mean, in varying degrees, depending on who and where they were, but nevertheless, they'd lived through years and years of terror. What was their take on this case? Did they believe what they read in the media? What did they? How did they feel about it? How did they hold it?
Yeah, they read in the media. Guatemala's a country. It's like a lot of places. Yeah, and especially in those years, if the news media, it's a very complicated thing, but if the news media is basically generating 90% propaganda, you know, for decades, you begin to believe that. You also are living in a society where nobody who claims, after years and years and years of being disillusioned by people, by every time somebody looks like they might be, you know, a good person who's going to bring positive change, like the first democratically elected president Guatemala had as the war was winding down, Benicio Cerezo, for example, and they turn out to be just incredibly corrupt people. I mean, it's just one letdown after another. So there's a basic cynicism in Guatemalan society. When you have a place where there's no justice, where justice never works, it just breeds this kind of cynicism, so you just always sort of want to believe the worst. And it's very hard to get real information to people. And so when all this publicity campaign goes, and so if all you're hearing everywhere is that it was this lurid theatrical scandal, people tend to believe it, right? And they had lots of fake evidence. They could really, this thing was really, really well planned.
Yeah.
That's what made it so hard to fight against. And so I'm telling you, for early years of that case, until just a few years ago, the guys and my friends and the honest prosecutors who later came on the case were really kind of stigmatized. People saw them as liars. As
including you, what was your role in this whole thing? Were you branded as a...
Yeah, I got very close to them. After the New Yorker article appeared, which was the first place where a case against the military, even at that point, even though at that point it was it's just the kernel of the case, right? Just a little bit we had. But it was the first time that was laid out in public. And then the one really good, heroic Guatemalan newspaper, El Periódico, run by my good friend Chepe Zamora, ran it in Spanish. And
they ran the New Yorker article.
Yeah, and wow. That was the first time, you know, and that paper had some excellent reporters working on the case, Claudia Mendez, most of all, who's an important character in the book. And that was the first time, you know, that scenario was laid out before the Guatemalan public. But by that point, after that piece came out, I was basically almost kind of found myself becoming part of the story all the time also. And so, so that's how we went forward. I ended up realizing that this was really the story of my life, really. I'll never, ever expect to find a story that's so human and so dramatic and so extraordinary. And I lived it for 8 years. And it reaches a point, and I guess we're still sort of there, where I kind of begin to work with them a little bit. You know, for instance, even though the book is done, I have the Spanish language edition is coming out, and I can write a new afterword for the Spanish language edition, and I have some new information. And I know the head church lawyer, my good friend, Mario Domingo, has new information, and we're going to meet up by the... He has to go to a university in the United States for a few days to give a talk. And I'm going to be in Mexico City, which we're going to go to a border town and meet and trade information.
Oh, my goodness. Just so. Most people are trading drugs in those border towns. So. We're talking to Francisco Goldman. It's actually time to go, but I wanted to ask you one more thing, which is, is there any hope? Do you have any hope for a kind of democratic justice in Guatemala at this point?
Well, yeah, because justice was done in this case. And I think that, that's how you build slowly faith in a legal system, that you set some precedents. I think we're going to see more, or I think a new round of arrests in this case is coming. I think that, and from what I hear from people, the success they had on this case, a lot of extraordinary people contributed. This was not just four friends. We haven't had time to mention that
right here.
You have throughout the Guatemalan justice system now, veterans of this case, six or seven prosecutors, judges, all down the line, and I hear that they're seeing the effects of that. You have a president, a center-left president, who is sympathetic to both this case and to try to strengthen the justice system there. And you have the United...
And you have a lot of center-left presidents in other countries nearby.
Yeah, but that won't really help in Guatemala.
It doesn't.
No. And you have... the UN is back, which is a big thing. Because the first ever United Nations committee empowered to investigate clandestine groups has set up office in Guatemala. It's so important to have foreign involvement of that kind in these kinds of countries. It's almost impossible to do things like the Bishop Harari prosecution if you're on your own in a country like Guatemala, because they'll just kill you. But if people are aware that international groups like the United Nations and even the United States, when they want to play that kind of role, are behind you and are following your case and are keeping an eye on what's going on, then that supplies protection. And so I think one reason this is a case, it's important to remember this, 17 people associated with this case, witnesses and so forth, have been murdered already. Almost everybody involved in the case, after they testify, they have to go into exile. A lot of the justice workers had to go into the exile. But the United Nations had been there as they were with the peacekeeping force and now with the commission on clandestine groups, everybody would be dead. You know, and that kind of attention has protected the main players.
Francisco Goldman is the author of the book, The Art of Political Murder, Who Killed the Bishop? And he will be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe, and it's part of the College of Santa Fe's lecture series, Rebels, Revolutionaries, and Reformers. It's free lecture, open to the public. Francisco Goldman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to also say, I just loved your first novel, The Long Night of White Chickens, and if anybody is interested in reading any of Francisco Goldman's books, you won't be sorry.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. Robert Knott will be back with us in just a moment. And Robert Knott is with us, and he will be with us, speaking with us in just a minute. But first, I'd like to welcome Daniel Werwath. He is the Resource Development Manager at the Housing Trust and is here to talk to us about an event that's coming up. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here. So this weekend, we're doing an event special for homeowners called Sustaining Homeownership with the current...
In this crazy time.
And the idea is we felt at the Housing Trust that it was time to do some kind of more public outreach events that look at avoiding foreclosure and making sure people get to the resources they need to stay out of foreclosure and do things like lower their monthly energy bills and things like that.
And so is there a lot of increase in foreclosures happening in Santa Fe?
Well, we've been really lucky up to this point. And I think... you know, generally speaking, compared to a lot of other places in the state, we've had a relatively low rate. But we want to make sure it stays that way. And even a few foreclosures is too many. It's a really trying experience for homeowners, and it's something that, if, you know, a foreclosure could affect a family for years to come. So it's really important.
What are some of the actual things that people can do?
Well, you know, the biggest thing we find is that people who are eventually foreclosed on their homes, over 50% never make any efforts to even contact their lenders. And that's one of the really important things right now. More and more we're finding lenders being willing to work with people to modify their loans, to defer payments till people can get caught up. They lose a lot of money from foreclosing on a home, and banks are not in the business of owning real estate. They tend to lose anywhere from 20 to 40% of the principal amount of their loan when they foreclose. So they have a lot of interest in trying to make sure that there's an opportunity for the homeowner to stay in the home and the loan to be modified. And there's a lot of great national level resources for that, and that's one of the things we're trying to focus on. There's a helpline that's a national helpline that has free counseling. These folks work directly with your lender to work out plans. They can also help with budgeting, things like that. It's called the HOPE line. It's 1-888-995-HOPE. And so that's really what the effort's focused on here in Santa Fe, because we don't have a huge rate of foreclosure, but we still have enough where we're working hard in the public sphere to direct people to the resources there are. And organizations like the Housing Trust, you know, we typically work in helping people buy homes. And it's the front end stuff. We develop affordable housing. But for us, it's incredibly important to try and make sure that people who are in homes already don't lose them.
If people want to find out more and show up this weekend for the event, Sustaining Home Ownership, the workshop, how do they do so?
Well, for more information, they can call me directly at the Housing Trust. My number is 989-3960, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. The event's going to be from 10 until 12 o'clock at the Chavez Center this Saturday.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, exactly. And there's also a ski swap, so it's not all gloom and doom. You can come... Get your information.
Keep your house and get your skis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Daniel Werwath, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And he's with us today, as he is every Friday, speaking of the arts. And he's sitting here with his back turned to me.
I'm acting fluorescent.
What?
Hey, listen, Jim Turner wants people to know that if you're an actor... that he is going to be videotaping and online posting actors' monologues at the Holiday Inn tomorrow from 1 to 3. But you got to pre-register. Check out his website, which I think is Blue Canyon. I know it's around here somewhere. Blue Canyon. Check out BlueCanyon.com. You can find Jim Turr. Just do, HotReadings.com. HotReadings.com. That sounds kind of naughty. I'm going to give you a hot reading. It sounds like a psychic who maybe is really ultra sultry, like Elizabeth Scott or something. Although I think she liked girls. Anyway, which is fine with me because I did too. By the way, the New Mexicans running its 208 holiday writing contest. You can write a holiday story. It's for children, teens, and adults. There's three different categories, which is why they do children, teens, and adults. Anyway, the deadline's Tuesday, November 25th, which is a couple days before Thanksgiving. And you got to mail your entries to Pat West Barker at the paper. There's a little ad in the Paso Tiempo on page 92. So if you want to write a holiday story, they're going to be published in Paso Tiempo on the 19th. This is a great issue. There's a lot of good stories there. I'm really proud of it, even though I had nothing to do with it. Dave Albin, California blues rock guy, he's going to be playing a gig tonight. Paul Weideman interviewed him. Two shows, 7 and 8:45, gigs on 2nd Street. Call the Lenzik, 988-1234. Meanwhile, Tony O'Brien has a show opening at Verve, which includes a lot of images he took in Afghanistan. He's a wonderful photographer. Verve is over on Marcy Street, 219, and the reception is tonight. Pardon me. The reception and the book signing of his book, Afghan Dreams, is tomorrow, 2 to 4. Phone number, 9825009. Really nice piece in today's Paso Tiempo, also by Paul Weideman. I was thinking of a piece that Doug Fairfield did on, it's called Global Swarming. It's about the opening of the exhibit, The History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro.
Well, that's something we need to talk about, because that's an amazing event that's opening tomorrow. There's a panel discussion from 3 to 5 with Charles Bowden and Julian Cardona.
Correct.
And
Tipton Hall.
Who else is it? We did an interview on this just yesterday, actually, here on the Radio Cafe. Nancy Suter is the curator who made this amazing exhibition happen. And it's all about border issues, but not in the sort of typical, media conversation, but rather with these, and Michael Berman, these incredible photographs by these two artists and writing and speaking by Charles Bowden, who's an amazing writer.
And then the panel discussion is followed by a reception and catalog signing at 5 o'clock.
That's right.
So all this stuff's at Tipton Hall. The panel discussion's at Tipton Hall, but the actual reception's at Santa Fe Art Institute.
Which is right next to Tipton
Hall. They're both on the College of Santa Fe
campus. On the campus of the College of Santa Fe.
You can get there by bus, you can get there by car. You can get there on a bicycle. It's free. 424-5050. You should go. There's a lot of political
SFAI.org
cultural events.
Well, also
up this week.
Francisco Goldman, whom we just talked to on this show, who is a truly amazing writer. I've been reading his work since his first novel came out, and he's speaking tonight at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe
right.
at 7 o'clock. That's another free
That's
event,
also free, yeah.
And it is a tremendous privilege to have him in town. He knows more about Guatemala than just about anybody.
And then the journalist Jonathan Schell, who's been with the New Yorker for so long, and who's
That's
often.
Right.
Written about anti-nuclear issues. He's coming here with the Lannan Foundation on Wednesday night, 7 o'clock, Lenzik, 988-1234. Not too expensive to get in. They always rebroadcast that, it seems to me, on KSFR 101.1 the following Sunday or something. But if you want to go to the event, Hamilton Fish is moderating. Jonathan Richards did a terrific Q&A with Shell, including a follow-up interview after the election to talk about the issue of what Obama would do about nuclear weapons worldwide. So it seems like a lot of not coincidental post-election political / artistic events occurring.
And speaking of the College of Santa Fe, there's at Body of Santa Fe, which is right across the street on Cordova Road here, there's a College of Santa Fe student show at 7 o'clock tonight.
Okay, and we don't want to overdo the College of Santa Fe. This is pure coincidence, but just to get off the political stuff, the Comedy of Errors. Two sets of twins running around town dressed in the same clothes. I saw Laurel and Hardy do this in The Three Stooges. This is great. They did different stories about it. But anyway, it's over. Mario Cabrera directs 8 o'clock tonight through the weekend, next weekend as well. I'm going to go see it. And there's a story in today's Paso Tiempo by moi.
By you?
Yeah, me. What do you know about the Cronus Quartet?
Oh, they're an amazing string quartet that plays very unusual music in their inimitable style, and it's tomorrow night at the Lenzik.
You're right, 7:30. Did you ever see that old science fiction movie, Cronus, about a huge robot creature that, sucks all the energy out of everybody? It's from
Why
the
no?
50s. It's really good. I saw that. Last night I was playing volleyball with Southwest Sciences. They're nice enough to let me go play on their team, since the New Mexicans team sort of fell apart. And one of the ladies on the team who listens to your show and likes your show, she said that whenever I serve, I stick my tongue out when I'm serving in volleyball. And I thought that's fine with me because I stick my tongue out all the time.
At the Center for Contemporary Arts, there is a Festival of Water Films opening tonight. There's a film called Flow, For Love of Water, and it's the whole question of can anyone really own water? It's called The Inconvenient Truth for Water Issues. And they examine the decreasing fresh water supply all over the world through the lens of pollution and politics and human rights and the weirdly emerging water cartel. And tonight at 7:30, that film will be introduced by the head of Bioneers, Kenny Ausubel. And tomorrow it will be, it'll show at 3:30 with a performance conceived by Elizabeth Weinman and Dominique Mazot. And at 5:30, there will be that same movie introduced by Renee Haas of Food and Water Watch. And then on Sunday, Basia Ireland will be introducing the film at 4 and 6. So there's a lot going on with that film and much, much more. So, and also the film The Pool, which I love and which is still at the CCA, continues to screen over there. So ccasantafe.org is the website.
And speaking of movies, this is the weekend of James Bond.
Yay.
Daniel Craig in Quantum of Solace over there at Regal Stadium 14. I got to go review it. I only have $5 on me. I'm going to pay $7 to get in, so I'll have to borrow $2 from somebody, maybe you. So that's going to be over there if you like James Bond, and I do. I grew up on James Bond. Who was your favorite James Bond?
Sean Connery.
How come?
I don't know. I guess that was the first couple of James Bond films I ever saw were Sean Connery.
Oh, that's interesting. Santa Fe Performing Arts presenting Cinderella again this weekend. Armory for the Arts, directed by Meg Burns, 984-1370. This is also the weekend of Alice in Wonderland. Alice in Wonderland, the funniest Wonderland we know. That's at the James A. Little Theater, presented by the Pandemonium Productions Players. I think that's, it's 2 o'clock tomorrow. I'm trying to figure out what time it is tonight. I think that it's going to be 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock. So if you're looking for children's theater, you got Alice in Wonderland at one theater, you got Cinderella at the other. And you know what, come to think of it, I think that Southwest Children's Theater might be doing a show too, called something like Baba Yaga and Vasila. Do you know that story?
No.
It's a Russian folktale about a witch and her walking house. You were talking about the home ownership problem earlier with the mortgage guy. I'm glad I don't own a home. They'd be trying to repossess my apartment as it is anyway. If you had a walking house, you could probably circumcise a lot of these problems that people have when they're being faced with mortgage issues because you just get up
and
leave.
I really deeply hope you mean circumvent.
Well, get around them is what I mean. Anyway, getting back to Baba Yaga and her walking house, it's 2 and 6 o'clock Saturday at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And that's interesting, a walking house. That'd be great. You just move to Gallup with your house. That would be really interesting.
Speaking of other movie theaters, and back to the College of Santa Fe, actually, the film Trouble the Water continues at the screen at the College of Santa Fe, and the play The Unexpected Man, which I saw last weekend, which is very good, also continues at the College of Santa Fe at the screen. It's one of the few non-movies being shown in that movie theater. And apparently there's a Patti Smith movie that is showing today and through the weekend as well.
Recycle Santa Fe Art Festival. What do you know about it?
You tell me.
Well, let's say you got some stuff that you want to recycle. It's one man's junk and it's the wife's treasure. You say, I know, let's compromise. We'll turn this into a piece of art. You don't want to put it outside in your front lawn. So what do you do with it? I haven't got a clue. But I do know the New Mexico Recycling Awareness Month is this month, which is November. And the Recycle Santa Fe Arts Festival takes place this weekend at El Museo Cultural from today through Sunday. They're at 1615 Pasadena Peralta near the railroad tracks. Visit recyclesantafe.org or call the following number for scheduling some information. 603-05, quick improvise for me, 0558. Recycle Santa Fe.
And Impact Personal Safety is a group that teaches people, especially women, self-defense. And they are having their graduation this coming Sunday. Well, let's see. It says Sunday, November 12th, but that can't be right because it's already November 14th. So I guess it's Sunday, November 16th. And for more information, you can go to impactpersonalsafety.org or call 992-8833.
Are they going to do like karate stuff demonstrations as part of graduation? Yeah. Wouldn't that be funny if they started like showing each other how to fight by beating up bad people in the audience?
There are no bad people in the audience.
Well, like if if it's an open house graduation.
But I suppose there could be. If any bad people want to show up, you're going to be in big, big trouble. That's all I can say.
That's right. Can you imagine if, like, I showed up just to be supportive and they said, we need a volunteer, and somebody pointed at me, and then they brought me up on stage and it was like they were kicking and karate chopping me and jujitsu and stuff?
So there's an ongoing book sale benefiting the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society at the Toy Auto Man, which is Monday, Thursday from 7 in the morning till 6 at night. They're at 4774 Airport Road, and they collect books. So if you have any books that you want to donate, go ahead and donate them to Toy Auto Man. But there's a lot of great hardbacks there, new books, variety of topics, and all donations go to the Santa Fe Animal Shelter. And for more information, you can call Claudia at 983-9463.
And it seems that the Santa Fe Playhouse has perhaps not quite fully cast its upcoming production of Arsenic and Old Ice. It's about two dames, sisters, who murder men, throw them down in a cellar. I forget why they do it, but it's for beneficial reasons. Anyway, the show goes up in mid-December. They're looking for a leading role actor, probably to play the part Cary Grant played in the movie, but I'm not positive. Male actor, 35 to 50. Needed immediately. Call the following number if you want to audition. 438-0070. Arsenic and Old Lace. Remember that movie with Cary Grant?
I do indeed.
That's funny. He's jumping on. Priscilla Lane was in that. She was beautiful.
And the Chevet and Dongo Quartet returns to El Farol tonight at 9:30. An evening of cool Latin jazz and hot Afro-Cuban salsa.
Hot.
And then tomorrow, Saturday, it's the classic traditional Cuban sounds of Coiba with special Coiba. Guests at Chispa at El Mason. No cover charge for that.
Pretty good stuff.
And you can go, if you want to hear more about, see more about Nacho Mendez, you can go to Nachacha Music. That's like myspace.com/Nachacha Music.
Now, what do you know about slander, gossip, and rumors?
Oh, I don't indulge in those things.
Yeah, that's why you and I never hang out outside of the radio show, despite what people think.
I know.
Santa Fe Pro Musica is going to present some music that perhaps the gossipy salonniers of the 18th century Paris might have passed on. This weekend, it's going to be called Gossip and Slander. Concerts are at 8 o'clock Sunday, Saturday, 6 o'clock Sunday at the Loretta Chapel. That's a fine thing to bring into a church, Gossip and Slander. That stuff's terrible. I wonder what the priest
is doing
with Mrs. Miller and things like that. The repertoire is going to take in some works by people like Telemann, Rameau, Boyce Mortier, Mondeville, and a bunch of other guys whose names I couldn't possibly pronounce. And it's going to be guest violinist Mary Springfels. Actually, she's a violist da gamba player. If you know what that means, write me a letter. Put a $5 spot in it, will you?
And on Monday at the once more Santa Fe Art Institute, Hamid Nafisi lecture and screening of Adam Egoyan's Calendar. That's a film, and so they'll be screening the film, and he will be talking about it, and he is a film scholar. And that is happening at Tipton Hall on Monday the 17th at 6 o'clock, and it is very inexpensive to get in, sfai.org or 424-5050.
Want to go to a lecture about how the Nazis stole art and the problems trying to get the work back?
Yes.
Ronald D. Spencer is going to be speaking of Untouched by Nazi Hands, but still, .. 4 o'clock Sunday, St. Francis Auditorium, New Mexico Museum of Art downtown. You got to pay to get in. Phone number, 476-5072. And I got to say, Craig Smith did a nice job interviewing Ronald Spencer for today's Pasatiempo. What time is it?
It is 8:58. Oh, my goodness. It's time to go. One more. Bread, Soup, and Friends, 5:30 on Wednesday, November 19th at the Quaker House. Welcome to all. A simple midweek meal. Time to rest, replenish, and make new friends. For more information and RSVP, 438-4368.
There's a lot of men here today. There's hardly any women.
I don't know what to say to that. Maybe that's true. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. Robert Knott is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo, Friday Arts Magazine in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. And he's done this whole show with his back turned to
I'm
me.
Just looking out. For once, I decided to look at the people, at my adoring fans, not one of whom's paying attention.
They are not paying attention.
That's because it's all men.
Well, what can I tell you?
Oh, look, here comes
KSFR streams live on the web at KSFR.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@KSFR.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Jazz a la Carta.
This is very strange facing out. I don't usually see, this is what you usually say.
I do. I see the the crazy mix of humanity coming and going.
Here?
To-ing and fro-ing.
Sounds like Casablanca with S.C. Zackel saying that. Here they come, they go. Nobody knows what happens.
Yeah, well, that's what we have here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. And it's very nice. It's a great place. Good pastries, good caffeinated beverages.
I don't think I stick my tongue out when I play volleyball.
I don't really have a comment
on
that.
Next time I see her.
So,
fine thing to say, get my hands on her. Wow.
What are you doing this weekend, Robert?
Man, I got to watch a movie from the screen. I got to probably go see Comedy of Errors. I'm going to got to see a movie for the Film Fest. I'm going to try to, it's tough. I'm going to try to sleep, too.
Well, have a wonderful weekend. Be happy.
Do it. Say it.
have a great weekend,
no,
Robert.
No, that's not the word. Come on.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
No, you know what I want to hear you say.
Hasta la vista,
no,
baby.
No, it's one word and it starts with a C.
Cat. Cauldron.
I'm going to moita you.
Okay, ready? Ciao.